This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So, Nico, thank you again for taking that document, that PDF file, and turning it into a Word document that turned eons into cons. And as we were reading it today, I wish we could have stopped and explored the cons instead of the eons of trouble. Maybe Trout will do that using the document you made or you helped make. But our gratitude to Thomas Cleary for translating this vast book. And the beginning of it says it's volume one. So is volume two included in volume one? I'm not sure. It's a pretty vast document, as all of you have seen. So you might explore that. So this afternoon, we're honored to have a very old Sangha member, student of Koban, Chino Odagawa Roshi, and I think one of the first to be ordained in his lineage too, as I think I might've heard. So welcome, Trout, and thank you for participating, joining us today, leading this, doing this talk.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I was unmuted. I just want to remark about this morning that what I really loved was everybody being involved. So what I'd like to do is speak a little bit, and then I really relish hearing from each of you. It was really wonderful this morning. It was really fun. And I thought we learned a lot from the exchanges that we had. So I just want to keep doing that. I want to begin by telling a story that I feel like parallels and illuminates this sutra. There's a wonderful man named Craig Childs who lives and writes a lot about the Southwest, in particular Southern Utah, and all that goes on down there. He's written a bunch of wonderful books, and he also wrote a wonderful article that was published in something called High Country News, where he tells the story of a backpack trip that he took. And the trip began in a place called Chaco Canyon that some of you may know of, or maybe most of you know of. It's an ancient Anasazi ruin. And when you go there, you're aware that it is a ruin, but it's an incredibly beautiful place. The old walls of buildings and huge walls of kivas are there. And he was gonna trace His intention was to trace a route that they'd begun to find when they started taking pictures of this area of the Southwest from high up satellites. They saw a whole bunch of roads that we didn't know existed that were really old roads, and road isn't the right word, they were old trails. And there was a trail that went straight from Chaco Canyon north, and it went up into Southern Colorado to a place where there was an incredible view looking south. And he decided to retrace those steps. So he put on his backpack, and I apologize to Craig if I'm misdescribing parts of this, but I understand the journey that he was on. And he started off just walking out of Chaco Canyon through some beautiful areas that still had old Anasazi ruins in it. And then eventually he was walking through the desert of that area of New Mexico. And as he was walking along, he was just noticing how beautiful it was. And then he began to come upon oil wells. And he saw one far off in the distance and said, "Oh, God, I forgot there's just going to be all these oil wells on this journey, and I'm not going to enjoy that." And he just continued to walk, and he slept a night kind of where he couldn't see the oil wells, and then got up the next morning and continued to walk north. And as he walked, he began to see more and more and more oil wells, and wells where they had gone down to get oil, in fact, were bringing up natural gas, and he saw pipelines going off in different directions. And as he continued to walk, his annoyance at the oil wells began to disappear. And he began to see everything without any kind of judgment. He began to see everything without any feeling of what's good or bad. He began to see things just as they were. On the back of my Rakasu a long time ago, Coben wrote, "Things are what they are." And we've certainly heard that expression a lot lately, but there's something very important in that. And as Craig walked further north, he went through some towns and went through some more intense place of oil wells. And when you read the article, you realize that he got, as he went through some of the most difficult places he possibly could, he got a deep sense of peace. Whether he was looking at oil wells or whether he was looking at pinyon trees or juniper trees or leftover signs of the Anasazi that lived there. And by the time that the journey comes towards the end, he's in a state of equanimity, and he's not a meditator. He's not a Buddhist scholar. He's a person who really has learned from the land and from his experiences on the land. But I was so touched by that sense of equanimity that he got, even though there were a lot of difficult things to be seen. And he stopped seeing them as difficult and just saw them as what they are. And I thought of Craig's journey during the last 3 days when we've been doing the sutra, and of the journey that the sutra is. There's some difficult things in the sutra that contradict some of the things that we've learned, and then there's wonderful things in the sutra that affirm things that we've learned, and there's the overwhelming experience of just hearing the sutra. This morning, for those of you that weren't here, I talked about being in a river and just going down the river and going through rapids and going through calm spaces and seeing things we want to see, and then we keep going down the river and they become disappeared. But I just wanted to share that vision that Craig had. And we all know those times when we're sitting, and I love the expression shikantaza, just sitting. There's so many times when we're sitting and we're being visited by all these difficult oil wells of our lives, or anger, or jealousy, or hurt, or ecstasy, or remembering really great things. And then sometimes when we're sitting, we're just sitting. And we see these things come and we just notice them. And how profound and wonderful that kind of thing is. And I feel like when we sit back and listen to this sutra, it's a little bit like we get washed over by the sutra in a way that in fact cleans us and clears us. I'm tempted to just go on talking, but I'm actually more interested in just hearing if any of you have, well, if just the story of what I just told strikes anything for any of you. And as you may have learned, I'm going to be quiet for a bit and then just listen if anyone has any comments. And otherwise, I'm going to go on. But please don't worry about me going on. I can go on and on and on and on. So I'm just wondering if that story strikes anything for anyone.
It's kind of an annoying story because one of the reasons I wanted to do this Avatamsaka Sutra is that it's supposed to show the interpenetrating aspects of phenomena and help us take care of this planet. And then you talk about oil wells. So I guess they're part of this planet. We're also studying in our science and Buddhism. Once a month, we're studying about the climate crisis, the eco-dharma, and how we're at tipping points where things are going to radically change for us. And it's actually the sutra is considered a sutra healing and helpful to us to be good agents in taking care of this planet. Mm-hmm. But I guess there is equanimity we can take even in the midst of all destruction. Maybe that's part of what this is about.
Thank you, Doug. I feel like you were walking with Craig through that desert. And what do we do when we see the oil wells? And we, you know, we all know we get in cars and drive to Jokoji. You know, so. And I 100%, as you know, I've been the director of, or I don't know if you know or not, I've been the director of different programs, you know, that have supported climate change and really paying attention to that kind of thing. Now, that I think is why the Craig Child story means so much to me. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate your acknowledging that it's annoying and difficult to hear in the context, especially of the sutra. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you very much. You and I have this kind of relationship where we can rub shoulders against each other in a good way. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Pamela?
I really enjoyed this story. Didn't find it irritating, but I see your point of view, Doug. And I kept going back to the first part of the sutra study and the suffering that we pick up when we name things as somehow apart from us. And it just really struck me that his journey of seeing these interfering objects that are dirty and noisy and ugly in this beautiful big view of time and space, and suffered for having named them and made them his, like he was personally insulted by their presence. And then over time, he became friends with them in a way that allowed them. And to Doug's point, I think when you allow what's actually going on right here, then you can actually help the planet go forward from there. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad to talk about Jocko Canyon. That's one of my favorite places. I spent quite a bit of time there back when I was living in New Mexico. I've been there in the snow and the rain and the heat, and it's all been quite wonderful experiences there. That is the remains of, as you mentioned, an Anasazi civilization, which was an agricultural society and a trading society also. And so it had a lot of ceramic storage pots there, in which were found feathers from tropical birds and even bits of chocolate in special containers. And it's a part of the civilization that led to some of the pueblos that are still viable and quite alive in New Mexico. I have many friends there. But that civilization started there and grew and flourished and then dwindled and eventually collapsed. And some of the people there took some of those paths and probably the roads that your friend walked to the north, to Southern Colorado, to the Mesa Verde area where they were able to survive. But what had happened to them, as archaeologists view it now, was climate change. So there was a period in about the 11th and 12th centuries of this era and after of drought, and that agricultural society is down in a basin and their water table that they had to rely on to grow their food dropped, and they didn't have technology to pump that water up. So they began to starve and they had to leave their city basically. And but the people who left, many of them found other places to be and to survive on their own in new villages and pueblos. So they faced climate change in the extreme. And there are records that that wasn't an easy thing to go through. There are records where they turned on each other, different groups of them attacked each other trying to obtain food. It was not a pretty thing. And so it was beyond irritating. It was ugly. And but very, very real. And it has its beauty. That place has its wonder and its beauty. I've been there on full moons where the moonlight comes through the openings inside the walls of the pueblos and shoots daggers of light across the inside that are used to mark the monthly seasons, or were used to mark the times of year for agricultural purposes. It's quite beautiful, but it has other aspects associated with it as well. So, and that's a possible indicator of what we're going through now. We are indeed facing inexorable climate change. And just as those people had overgrown the ability of the earth to support them there under changing conditions, it is quite possible that humankind today has overgrown the ability of the earth to sustain us under changing climate conditions, which we have wrought with those oil wells and other aspects of our activity. These are the thoughts that come to mind. I'll stop going on and on, but it's a picture of both sides. It's beyond irritating and beautiful. And it's very interesting how your friend, the backpacker, came to be at peace in his travels there. So I think this sutra holds many keys for us, many teachings for us to be able to do that kind of thing in our time.
Thank you. Well, I want to talk a little bit about another part of a specific part of the sutra. The Craig Child's journey, what made me think of that was the passage on page 304 at the top, and it says, "And just as water is uniform yet differs in shape according to the vessel, so is the Buddha's field of blessings. It differs only due to beings' minds." And what that brings up for me is that it's how we look at something in a lot of ways that makes the difference, rather than how, well, it is no way, it just is. That's a really worthwhile differentiation. And then I want to go to page 307, that's just how I'm looking at it, just in terms of this. And he talks there, or the sutra talks, on 307 and 308, about something that the sutra refers to as the first settling up of a foundation. And this is quite actually different than most of the other parts of the sutra. And it says, it's like first setting up a foundation, then building the room. Generosity and self-control like this are bases of enlightening beings' practices. Just like building a castle to protect all the people, so are tolerance and effort protecting enlightening beings. And just as a universal monarch can bestow all felicities, so can kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity give enlightening beings happiness. And that's the only place that I saw in the sutra where it sounds like the sutra is saying, not here's how to become enlightened, but that it's important to set up a foundation in our practice. And when I looked at the flow of the last 3 days and then later on, and I came back and I looked at that, the idea of setting up a foundation of generosity and self-control, of tolerance and effort. Effort speaks to the people that were saying that they were lazy, which I'm sure were not the lazy people here earlier today. kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then it says at the end, brings happiness. And we had a discussion of happiness the first day when Mike was talking. And some people were not wild about the word happiness. They thought that didn't resonate. And I want to just, and the Dalai Lama talks about happiness too. So what we're talking here about in some kinds of ways is how can we learn from this flood of words how to go forward in our lives? And to me, a man who loves words, my most clear feeling about words is really a lot of one thing that seems to be repeated again and again and again in our practice. And that is that words can't reach it. That there are sutras, there are books, there are all kinds of things. But words can't reach it. And that there's a knowledge deep inside of us that words can't reach. And I want to tell another story, and this is about myself. In fact, it turns out to be in the Southwest again. I was at a campground at a place called Canyon de Chelly, and I was sitting having some dinner, and a car drove in at night. And as it drove in, it cast a shadow of somebody sitting zazen or sitting meditation on the wall of the bathroom. And I saw the shadow and looked at it, and I knew who it was that was sitting there. And there's no words that can describe how I knew that. And I got up and walked over to where the shadow source was of the person sitting there. And I said, "Eric?" And the person that was sitting there said, "Trout?" And it was Eric Remington, whom I don't know if he still lives at Jokoji, but I know was living at Jokoji for a while and sat beside me for a good many, many, many sittings at Haiku Zendo. And I had no idea what it was about the way that this shadow was, or that Eric was, that I could see his shadow and know it was Eric Remington. I mean, I'd sat with, you know, probably 30, 40 people. You know, we think of the times out at Hidden Villa when we had sessions. And I want to just bring that particular story up because it involves Jokoji and involves some of you, you know Eric. And it really demonstrates this knowledge that we have inside of us that we don't know we have. And sitting zazen is a way for that knowledge to manifest itself inside of us. The wordless, indescribable knowledge that's inside of us. And I feel like one of the wonders of this sutra, and thank you, Doug and Nico and all of you that were involved in getting it to us, is that when you get washed by all the words, what you're left with is that deep knowledge that you have inside yourself. Because the words, one word will wipe out another word, will compound another word, and they'll stack up correctly and then fall apart. And what we're left with is, in some kinds of ways, one of the greatest, it's the greatest effort I've seen to overwhelm us with words and let us learn that it's not words that teach us. So I'm going to be quiet for a while, and I would just love to hear anything that anyone had to say. Thank you. Kavesh. Kaveh, yes.
Yeah, hi. I'm interloping here because I haven't been sitting in the session, but I'm so happy that I dropped in. You know, when I sat just this few minutes, when you were talking the story of the oil well, a lot of peace came to me. Just seeing, closing my eyes and listening to it. And afterwards, I think after Pamela was speaking, the image of this teaching story by Suzuki Roshi flashed to me, which may not make sense, but it's a famous story of him talking about the blue jay and sound and noise. It's on YouTube. And I think it was in the last year of his life when he was, you know, he didn't know, but he was on his way dying. And he says, he coughs constantly. He coughs a lot in that. And he says something like, you know, blue jays singing is irritating, you know. It's not... It can be irritating. It's not a typical bird noise. And he says, you know, you can let the blue jay come right into your heart. You know, and then what was noise becomes sound. It can even become song. So, you know, the oil wells of your life can become like riverbeds, you know, can become like shining, like stars that guide you on your journey, like on this road. One oil well, other oil well, hello, old friend. You know, so I'm sorry, I just, I wish I could. I mean, I see a lot of oil wells in my life. It's beautiful when the oil wells become like, you know, your friends. You know, I think this is the reason I love this practice, you know, to constantly open you up. So I just interloped in here. I'm so happy I came in. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't know you. It's nice to see you and hear you. Thank you. Now I know a little of you. Thank you.
Aren't those Steller's jays that are all over in Tassajara? And all sort of making commotion and being a nuisance. I wonder if that's what he was thinking of.
Thank you, Trout. Emmy, thank you for the reading and your stories. I'm gonna. There's so much to talk about. I really love the sutra. It's the first time I've ever looked at it. And I'm gonna just pick up on the story that you gave us this morning about the man walking. And I think that's what I'm doing reading this sutra. I keep looking at the language and looking at the words and finding maybe a flash of recognition and understanding. And then I might be back on that river like you talked about as well. And I might go down an eddy for a little while and swirl around in it and come back to the river. But all in all, what it seems to me is that we are living in such a world of duality and of ego and of mind. And sometimes we do grasp to understand it. And even to mention Mike's talk about happiness, I think that if we wonder or think about why we are studying the way, for me, it is to be happy. And a deep happiness. It's not a frivolous happiness. It's a deep understanding. And so this river, this sutra, reminds me of all these things in life, of all the phenomena. And so what I have to do is I have to float up a little way, and I have to float up a little further past the sky and past the atmosphere and into the universe and look down and say, yeah, it's pretty much gone in a flash. And this existence is so precarious and so precious. And from up there, there's nothing that we can grasp. There's nothing that we can hold on to, because it's all going to be gone pretty soon. So the sutra reminds me of, I'm being thankful for this cultivation, for this direction that they're giving us from the paramitas, from the sutras, from Buddhist teachings. And yeah. Whether I'm here or whether I'm floating around up above looking down, it's quite exceptional. So anyway, it's good to hear from everybody. And thank you. Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about Koban and his teaching and his way, and how there's a flip that I'll tell about too, that about a teacher that reminds us that there's so many different ways to learn. When we were in Haiku Zendo, or mostly it happened in Haiku Zendo, a few times at Chikoji, we would be talking, and there would be a time when there was a group of people around, like after we sat Zazen on Wednesday evenings. And I remember there was one time there was this guy that was there. I remember exactly where he was sitting. And when he began talking, it became really obvious to most of us that he wasn't there trying to learn anything, but at the moment that he was talking, he was trying to show how great he was. And we all know that experience when someone just goes on and on and on, and they're kind of showing how great they are. And Koban, and I heard this not just with this one guy, but Koban so many times, would just be with him. And he would just be, and I think of those words that I was mentioning before, he'd be generous and tolerant, and he'd be filled with kindness and compassion and equanimity. And I remember sitting there going, God, why don't you, you know, of course, I was never looking, putting a mirror in front of myself and saying, you dumb shit, Trout, you know, but anyway, that was what was going on inside of me. And I really remember that. And it really struck me deeply. And then another time after that, I was in Berkeley, and a man named Stephen Gaskin was talking at the Berkeley Community Theater. And he had a lot of people that were listening to him, and he had a lot of wise things to say. And Berkeley Community Theater was completely filled. And after he got done talking, he said, you know, are there any people that have questions or have something they want to say or do or something? And there were some people that got up and asked questions and were present. And then this guy got up and he started, like the same person did with in Haiku Zendo with Koban, he began to celebrate himself. And Stephen Gaskin listened for a while. And then when the guy paused, he said, what you're trying to do right now is rip off the energy of this meeting. And I want you to stop talking, please. And I remember hearing that and just being jolted in my seat. And even telling the story, I remember that feeling. And there are so many Zen stories about teachers that do things like that. If you think of all the koan study that we can do, there's a lot of times where teachers suddenly yell and someone gets enlightened or makes fun of a student. I love the story of the teacher that asked his student, why are you sitting? And the student said, because I want to become enlightened. And the teacher picked up a roof tile and began rubbing the roof tile. And the student said, what are you doing? And he said, if I rub this really hard, it'll become a mirror. And the student said, it can't become a mirror, it's a roof tile. And the teacher said, you can't become enlightened by just sitting. You are who you are. And so I thought of Stephen Gaskin and whether or not he in fact might have been being very generous when he said that to that man, and might have been tolerant, and he might have had kindness and compassion when he said that. That might have been exactly what that person needed at that moment. And when Koban was just the way Koban was, that might have been exactly what was needed. And so our practice is working with that foundation. What does it really mean to be generous and tolerant and have kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity? How do we do that?
Trump.
I still have the missing pieces of the sutra that I didn't print out on my mind, but I remember when you were reading it. That the part, I think it was in the part that we thought, yeah, that sounds like the paramitas. If someone has this quality that is a problem to you, not to one, but not to Buddha, then you direct them toward others who need their help, for instance. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear from you. I think there are others that are needing to speak, or, I mean, that's not exactly the same. That's politeness, but something like that. So I still feel offended by what Stephen Gaskell said that wasn't there, you know? Those are different times, and I won't have anything to say against Stephen Gaskell, but the part about the tile, rubbing the tile, that, you know, that wasn't really an insult. That was kind, a very kind thing to say. And other people I've heard emphasize that, yeah, you've got to keep rubbing the tile, though. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's like the comparison of Kogan and Stephen Gaskin, you know, that rubbing the tile or not rubbing the tile. And in a way, the sutra is filled with those kind of contradictions, one going one direction and one going another direction. And what I love about the sutra is I don't think there's anything it misses. I think everything is in there. And yet what we want to do is just simply be present and not bring any of the ideas of the sutra into being present. How do we do that? And that's the question, you know.
Yeah.
I haven't heard anybody say, that's wonderful, Paula, thank you. I haven't heard anyone say, oh, you should keep rubbing the tile, but I understand where that's coming from completely too. Yeah.
Oh, keep sitting, but just don't change your expectations.
Hello. There's a wonderful story, I believe, I hope I don't get it wrong, about the Russian mystic, Gurdjieff, mm-hmm. Who worked with groups trying to develop a, might say, an enlightened society. And there's a story about him often putting his students and his disciples to meaningless work. And there happened to be in the community a really irritating fellow, someone who everybody really despised. He would go into tantrums at the slightest offense. He also had an inflated ego and was always complaining about things and really disrupting the harmony of the community. And one day, Gurdjieff had his community digging up little pieces of sod meaningless labor and moving them to another area in the on the earth of their compound. And this was the last straw for this fellow. And he said, "I've had it, I'm out of here," got in his car and drove away. And everybody was thrilled that this fellow was finally out of their hair and they could, you know, do without that kind of troublemaker. Well, Gurdjieff got in his car and followed this guy. And it was a few days before he returned, bringing this fellow back with him and reinstalling him. Apparently he had convinced him to return to the community. And Gurdjieff's attendant in serving him lunch one day said, "Why did you bring this guy back? You know, everybody hates him. Everybody wants him out of here." And Gurdjieff said, "Look, don't, this is just between you and me. Don't tell anybody, but I pay this guy to be part of our community." He said, "It's the troublemakers, the people who offend us, that show us who we really are." And I think your story about Coben reminded me of this story, which there's the generosity of spirit, not just the tolerance of the oil wells, but they perhaps the actually seeing them as sculptural, you know, as welcoming them, as Gurdjieff said, paying him to be part of the Sangha. So thank you for affirming the role of the troublemaker in our lives.
Thank you so much. That's one of my absolute favorite stories. I tell it every once in a while, and you remember it exactly the way that it was written. And that's a wonderful story. And if we can welcome all the troublemakers in our lives and say, "Oh, thank you for being my teacher." That's one of my main practices in the world is, you know, to encourage people. You know, my wife will come home from work and she'll go, "Oh God," and she'll tell me about something and I'll say, "Oh, another teacher." And she'll look at me, she's sick and tired of hearing me say that, but she understands it and actually comes back. And sometimes the person will switch and be nice. And that's disarming too. But oh, I love that story. Thank you so much for sharing it. It's just wonderful. Thank you. Oh my gosh. Well, thank you a ton. I want to tell another story about Coben. One time at Hidden Villa, when we were having Sesshin, he led a Shosan ceremony where everyone could ask one question. And a woman, her name is Sarah, bowed before him and sat down in front of him and said, I'm so sad about some things that have happened in my life. I just can't stop crying. What should I do? And Coben was quiet for a while, as his way, and then he said, "You know, you don't have to stop crying. Just keep crying, and we'll all be crying with you." You know, and that was a moment when I felt like, if we were going to talk about that moment, it's like he expressed his compassion for Sarah, and he drew us all into his compassion for Sarah. And at that moment, we all were crying with her.
Nico, is that? You have a question?
No.
Could I ask something?
Yes, please.
I've heard that story before of, let's all cry with Sarah asking the question about crying. I wonder if there are more than you, I wonder how many people in this meeting were there for that.
I'm really old. That session, actually, I was the teacher of that session. And I got really excited about doing the Shosan ceremony. I mean, I was so young, oh God. Anyway, these stories about myself, I'm just such an idiot. But, and I was all excited about doing the Shosan ceremony, and then Coben showed up and did the Shosan ceremony. He was supposed to be there for the whole session, but he just never kept showing up. And so he asked me to just keep doing it, so. I don't know if any, it doesn't sound like anyone was there. Yeah. Balin might have been there in the hills, Paula, teaching environmental education, you know. But, thank you. It's interesting that you've heard that story before.
I think it was at another Zoom meeting at Jokoji. Uh-huh. Another Zoom session, maybe.
Well, we're about, I don't know how to wrap this all up, but And I don't know, I'm certainly 100% willing to just sit here as long as people want to talk, if it's okay with Doug. But I want to end what I'm saying by referring to part of the Genjo Koan. So many of us love that it's just an incredible piece of writing. And I love the different pieces of obscurity in it. And when you sit with that obscurity, it's not the same kind of obscurity as we normally think of obscurity being. But there's that one passage in the middle, or maybe it's towards the end, where he says, to study Buddhism is to study ourself. And what we've been talking about this evening is meeting all the parts of ourself, the oil wells inside of us and the Stephen Gaskins inside of us and the crusty guy from Gurdjieff inside of us, all of those people inside of us. And then Dogen says, to study the self, and this is translated, I've seen 11 translations of this. If you go on and punch Genjo Koan in the computer, and you'll just see all these different, and everyone translate the next part of it differently. To study the self is to forget the self, or to go beyond the self, or to have the self disappear, or whatever. And I think of what Zazen is, of sitting with yourself. And noticing all these different aspects of yourself. And then the next part says, and to forget the self, or to go beyond the self, is to be enlightened by all beings. And when we sit with that and realize that every phenomena is enlightening us, two things happen. One, you get an appreciation of the gifts of everything. And you also get an appreciation of what enlightening might just mean. So the idea of which we sometimes hear about, oh, I want to become enlightened. What we really have the opportunity to do is to continually be enlightened. And we're all in this together, all of us, the human beings here and the bark on the trees and the lizards and the birds and the clouds in the sky and the good things and the bad things or the difficult things, we're all in this together. And then the next part talks about body and mind falling off. And that's another aspect of the self disappearing. And you get the sense too that this body and mind continues to fall off. It doesn't fall off once and then it's gone. It doesn't work that way. And other people, I think Paula mentioned it. I think Mike mentioned the Genjo Koan. And Mike's written something really recently, really fine on the Genjo Koan. And the sutra, in a way, tells us so much wonderful stuff that our mind, there's no way we can ever hold this. And it almost touches everything, or it touches everything as best as they could do. And so what we're left with is ourself. And there is no self. We're just being enlightened continually.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.